Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. This is Stephanie McPheeters, the deputy editor of the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor is the nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to delivering high-quality, nonpartisan, investigative and explanatory journalism to inform Mainers about issues impacting our state and to empower them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. For more information on our work and how to support the Maine Monitor, please visit themainemonitor.org. This month, we're playing an excerpt from an event we held at the University of Maine at Augusta in December. The free event, co-hosted by the Maine Monitor and the Maine Indigent Defense Center, examined the origins of the state's indigent defense crisis, models in other states, and the rollout of Maine's new public defender offices. Lawyers from across Maine, along with experts from Massachusetts and New Hampshire, spoke to both the challenges the state is facing as well as potential solutions on the horizon. Robert Ruffner, director of the Maine Indigent Defense Center, began by saying that whether the state is living up to the Sixth Amendment, which guarantees criminal defendants the right to a speedy trial and the assistance of a lawyer, is in doubt. While there have been great changes over the last 15 to 20 years in how Maine provides representation for our poor and those in need, he said, the question still remains, are we meeting our obligations as a state and as a society? As of mid-December, more than 1,200 criminal and child protection cases in the state lacked an attorney. This is up from around 100 indigent cases in August 2023, when Maine Supreme Court Chief Justice Valerie Stanfill described the situation as a crisis. The first panel, moderated by government accountability reporter Josh Keefe, asked how Maine got itself into this situation. Robert Ruffner, along with Ron Schneider, the General Counsel and Vice President of Legal Affairs at the University of New England, and Tina Nadau, Executive Director of the Maine Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, discussed the ways in which defense lawyers resisted change over the years, and how the pandemic exacerbated the attorney shortage. The panelists also placed blame on prosecutors, saying they needed to bring fewer cases by focusing more on serious crimes and less on simple shoplifting and possession charges. Here's Josh Keefe kicking it off.
In August 2023, there were roughly 100 indigent criminal cases in need of attorneys. And at that time, Chief Justice Valerie Stanfill described the situation as a crisis. If 100 cases constitute a crisis, then I think we need some new word to accurately describe the situation as it stands now. As of yesterday, there were 972 criminal cases in need of an appointed defense attorney in Maine. Those cases represent nearly 800 individual defendants. Nearly 150 were in custody. And that's just the criminal side. There are another, again, this is my counting a spreadsheet up, but 170 parents in child protection cases waiting for an attorney, as well as several more cases in need of guardians ad litem. Maine is certainly not the only state with these problems. Some states don't even have the capacity to track these numbers. But in Oregon, for example, the number of criminal cases in need of a public defender stood at 3,200 in May. And that's when the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled the state had to release many indigent criminal defendants within 7 days if they weren't provided counsel. In that majority ruling, Judge John Owens wrote the following, which I think will be helpful to consider as we move forward today. He wrote, "The state arrests a citizen and incarcerates him pending trial. Days, weeks, and months pass without any legal representation. He seeks relief from the authorities. Surely a lawyer should help him. In response, he gets a shoulder shrug, a promise that they are working on it, and nothing more. He remains in jail without legal counsel or any relief in sight. You might think this passage comes from a 1970s State Department report on some autocratic regime in the Soviet bloc. Unfortunately, we do not need to go back in time or cross an ocean to witness this Kafkaesque scene. This is the state of Oregon in 2024, end quote. And I think we could all see that that could just as easily have been written about the state of Maine. There are steps being taken here. For the first time, Maine is opening public defender offices across the state. The ACLU lawsuit seems to be heading for a resolution sometime soon. But obviously that is a little comfort to people currently in jail, unable to secure the attorney the Constitution guarantees them. So how do we navigate the current situation and how do we get here? And to help us answer that is our panelists. I'll ask some questions. I haven't gone to law school, so if I'm off, if you guys want to take in different directions, please feel free. I'd love to have a sort of free-flowing conversation. There will be time for questions at the end, and if you're on Zoom, you can put questions in the chat and we will get to them. So to get started, I guess the big question is, how did we get here? And maybe, Ron, sounds like you've wrote about this quite a while ago. Maybe we'll start with you. I want to get all your perspectives on this, but how do we get to the place we're at today?
I don't know. How many hours do we have?
Yeah.
I think
it's on. One of the things that I wanted to say, I went back to read something, and it goes to what Rob was saying about why we care about this. And I am going to quote myself and Justice Dana, Howard Dana. And what I wrote then was, essential to being a member of American society is a healthy distrust of the power of the state. Part of being a person in the United States means that one can challenge the government's power to take away one's life, liberty and life. When a person is denied the opportunity to challenge effectively the government's power, that person has designed some of what it means to be a person in our society. And Howard Dana, the director of Legal Services Corp, said at one point, anyone who values this society values our fundamental liberties, has a stake in making sure that justice is available to everyone. So, I think that's a little bit of the non-legal reasons for caring. I guess for me, it started when I was a student attorney and had was representing people in court and had a jury trial as a student attorney on a felony assault on a police officer, and was handling an OUI manslaughter case, and thought, this is not really right. But then being in court, not a full-time criminal defense attorney, saw problems with the way things were going. You know, there was no application, there was no standards, no oversight. Judges would say to recent grads, come on over and put your name on the list, get some experience. And as a person who was there part-time, I saw things that were problematic and nobody was really doing anything about it. And I thought a public defender system, based on my experience of listening to people mostly in New Hampshire, I thought this was the way that we should go. So fast forward, this man, Rob, is on a mission of a lifetime and is moving forward, help create the Clifford Commission. And we came up with the Maine Commission on Indigent Legal Services. I think it's important to understand that while that was discussed, while Rob had his reasons, I had my reasons for why we wanted a individual commission created, it was originally a financial issue. The judiciary had typically delayed payments to people. The judges would cut fees for the lawyers. They'd present their invoices, the judges would cut them. Sometimes they would run out of money and people would have to wait 3, 4, 5, 6 months, wait till the next fiscal year to get paid. And at one point, the overrun, the budget overrun, had blown a $2 million budget hole in the judicial branch. So the chief was desperate to get that out of her budget. And so that moment helped create the commission. From day one, I will tell you this, I think it's okay. It wasn't completely confidential. But as he signed the bill to create the Maine Commission on Indigenous Legal Services, Governor Baldacci looked up and said, "So this isn't going to cost any more money, right?" I mean, yeah, it's a true story.
You would die now.
Yeah. So we knew from the very moment this was underfunded. We knew it was gonna. So what happened is we created the commission, turned the lights on, created a system so that people get paid. People got paid regularly, and then we spent almost all of our time begging for more money. We created standards, an application, the specialty panels. There was more work to do. I was a member of the ACLU, so I didn't get reappointed by Governor LePage, although he didn't realize we probably agreed on more than with respect to this issue. But then things started to fall apart, really. The new members weren't appointed to the commission. The standards weren't being enforced. People were being allowed to, it was artificially being held up. And so these specialty panels that we created to try to ensure that people had the skill to do the work, a homicide case. I know some domestic violence cases, serious felonies. We thought people should have, imagine that. We thought that they should have more than just being out of school and having taken a 1 day or 2 day training. The largest one, and I'll just say the judiciary, there was so much opposition to that. The Judiciary Committee room where we held the public hearing was packed with people opposing those specialty panels because it would hold people accountable. We actually got letters from people saying, "This is going to hurt my ability to build a practice."
Ron, when you're saying people, who are
Sorry.
you? Yeah.
Oh,
People are
lawyers. Lawyers. Sorry, lawyers.
defense lawyers.
Defense lawyers. Right.
At the time.
People, I did break the rule a couple of times on public hearings and cross-examine people a little bit on what they were actually saying and ask them, "So you think that you shouldn't have to have had a jury trial before trying a Class B felony? You shouldn't have had that experience." And most people could not admit that and say, "Sure, you should just do it, wing it for the first time." So anyway, it rolled along. Interestingly, we got pushback. I do want to say this. We got pushback from the Maine State Bar Association Young Lawyers section because this was going to interfere with young lawyers' ability to, again, enter the world of law and build a practice. That somehow there was people perceived a right for the lawyers to represent people who the state wanted to put in jail. By definition, everybody's looking at jail, right? That's how you get a lawyer. If you're not, if the state's not going to try to put you in jail, you don't get a lawyer in Maine. So anyway, it rolled along, kind of started to really fall apart. And then there was a deep concern about the money. Came back in 2019 with a newly established commission with 9 members. I rejoined with some of the current members, and then COVID hit, and everything went to hell. And I'm going to shut up in a second, but where I think why we are here, we are now, because people like me failed in the ability to make something happen that we wanted to have happen. And I don't know if anybody's ever read Robert Caro's book about, not Robert Caro, is it Robert? Sorry, about Robert Moses, about the power broker.
Yeah.
and how he wanted to do something. He had this vision for New York. And the first time he tried it, he failed because he didn't have any power. So then he spent his life amassing power and steamrolling everybody to get what he wanted. We didn't have power. I didn't have power. We tried to influence power. We influenced the Judiciary Committee. Didn't make a difference for the appropriations. It didn't make a difference with the governor. So the people in power didn't create what needed to be created. So what I used to say to people who were trying to say, it's going to have to all fall apart. It's going to have to crash. And that's what it did. And that's why we are where we are, where it crashed. And now we have people saying, oh, well, now we have to create public defenders offices. But COVID obviously changing demographics, younger people wanting to not the cowboys of the 70s and the 80s who went out and like the great lawyers that I worked with, you know, people like Peter Rodway, went out, hung his shingle. There were fewer of those people. Most people want a job. They want a salary. They want benefits. They want vacation. And the money just, it's very difficult to run the business. And COVID wore people down. It created a backlog in the court system. The judges became unyielding as they're trying to clear their dockets. And that's why a lot of people started to leave. And
Ron, could you define soon when you said you were going to stop talking soon?
Now.
Okay.
So that's why I think we're here.
I guess I'm curious. It sounds like in some ways you're describing almost criminal defense lawyers almost being protectionists about maybe their business interests in all this. And I guess I'm wondering if Tina or Rob, like, it has sort of the defense bar contributed to this in some way? Or I mean, I don't know. You want to take that however you.
Yeah, I'll speak to that. So I am the executive director of MacDole. That's what we call our organization, MacDole. I've been in this position for 7 years. I am well aware of the criminal defense bar pushing hard against the establishment of the commission, the establishment of any standards, the establishment of specialty panels. There was a huge outcry, I believe, in 2014 when then Governor LePage was not really creating a public defender's office, but he called it that. It seems as though for much of the time that the commission was established, anytime there was a suggestion that there might be either oversight or accountability or any of that, I think the private defense bar, of which, I mean, that's all we had, right, all this time, there was significant pushback, you know, absent a few people who have always, I think, been more globally minded about the issues of the system. So that has been a recurring issue. I will say, and one thing Ron didn't mention, in 2019, the Sixth Amendment Center, and I know David Carroll's here and he will speak, issued a report with basically the top 10 things that are wrong with our system. And that went over like a lead balloon in the Judiciary Committee, in the Appropriations Committee. I think a lot of the issues that were identified had to do with billing and oversight, but there were also indicators that there was no supervision or oversight of attorney quality. So if we're talking about the Sixth Amendment, sure, I guess billing is part of it. Money is always part of our analysis, but for me, it's always been a more qualitative issue. How are we ensuring that people are not just receiving constitutionally mandated counsel, but excellent counsel, because that's what they deserve? My perspective is not that was shared by, I would say, the majority of MACDL members. We have about almost 300 members now across the state. And there was a lot of outcry, I think, when that report came out, as far as, oh, the attorneys are horrible. They're saying we're horrible. There was a significant lack of insight, I think, into what the report was actually trying to accomplish. And yes, in 2020, unfortunately, the wheels kind of fell off. And I think with this big C crisis, I don't have a better word for crisis, something that I've always thought which is we need a public defender office in each district of Maine, just like they have district attorneys in each district of Maine. And then the private bar takes the conflict cases or the cases that the PD's offices aren't able to do. I think something switched where a significant chunk of the private bar saw that public defenders are not competition. They're necessary. We cannot do this work alone, clearly. I think it's essential in both making sure that the lower level cases are staffed appropriately, but these people are here. They are not just salaried and having benefits, but they are mentored, they are supported, they are trained. And we are developing, hopefully with this PD office program, the next generation of Maine defenders. It's vital. It's something that should have happened years ago. I'm glad to see the progress we're making. I'm a little concerned about what I've been hearing from legislative folks and other people in the governor's office regarding budget concerns for the coming biennium, as far as whether or not we'll be able to expand public defender's offices, both the number of them, but also the capacity within those offices to take on a number of cases. Like I said, criminal defense attorneys have not always been the greatest friend to progress in this area, but I think having lived through what we've lived through and seen what we've seen, and too often I think the fingers go this way to us being the problem here, I am hopeful that the defense bar will be even more supportive moving forward. For initiatives that help expand access to counsel and not take every change as a threat to them personally or their livelihoods.
You're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU-FM. This month, we're bringing you a panel of experts on the state's indigent defense crisis. You're listening to Robert Ruffner, Director of the Maine Indigent Defense Center, Ron Schneider, the General Counsel and Vice President of Legal Affairs at the University of New England, and Tina Nadau, Executive Director of the Maine Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, in a conversation moderated by the Maine Monitor's Government Accountability Reporter, Josh Keefe.
All right. Rob, I'm going to ask you about, we've heard about, obviously, these problems go way back, the pandemic happens, but the sort of the number of cases have really expanded in the last year and a half. And obviously it's been I'm sure the pandemic plays into that, but you know, it's 2024 at this point. I guess I'm wondering how you see that increase over the past sort of year. Like, why is it sort of coming to a head now and not earlier during the pandemic?
So I think it would be interesting to look at the population of Maine back in 2007 when the Clifford Commission was formed,
mm-hmm.
and now, and then compare the growth of cases in the system in that time, because I am sure that it has outpaced the growth in our population by several fold. I think that the reason things have come to a head so much in the last 4 years is because the pandemic accelerated and exposed a lot of fault lines that existed all along, and not just in the criminal system. Much of our clients, as I mentioned, are there because other parts of the safety net as a society that we think exists, when we don't have to take advantage of it or seek help from it, we think that there's this safety net that exists, really isn't there. And so the pandemic accelerated the number of people that had needs that couldn't get them met, which without other options, they end up getting dumped into the criminal system. In my office, we see a large percentage of cases of clearly individuals that need some mental health counseling, casework, and treatment that are in the criminal system. So the lack of services, the difficulty of getting services, drove more cases into the system. In addition, like every other industry, the last 4 years caused people to re-examine what they were going to do as careers and do in work. And the number of attorneys who decided to retire or move on to other types of work was accelerated by COVID. And at the time when people were examining from a business standpoint, you know, I think when COVID started, we were still at $60 an hour, that a law firm would get paid to have their attorneys represent individuals in court. And so when I think that during that time when people were doing the numbers, less of them viewed that as a viable business and frankly family option and being able to support themselves and their employees. And then everything was masked by Zoom. Because when we first transitioned to remote court and remote appearances, the capacity was artificially increased. The attorneys that were stuck with this and were dedicated to doing this work, when you can appear in four different counties from your desk very easily in the course of a day. And also, when you're stuck in court waiting for your case to be called, when you're doing it from your desk, there's a number of other responses that you could take care of. You could respond to emails from clients or to prosecutors. You could get a lot more done because of the nature of appearing remotely. But as remote appearances went away, it suddenly exposed that we were juggling, you know, six different flaming chainsaws, and we weren't going to be able to keep that up. And so the inputs were driven into the system and the cracks in the safety net. And then when it really hit the fan when we started going back to in-person appearances, because suddenly I can't be taking these cases in Washington County.
And cases aren't resolving either.
Right. Well, and that's another issue in terms of cases resolving. So I think that's why we've seen the acceleration. But I think a lens that all of our comments need to be viewed as is sort of even before Ron and I graduated from law school. So, you know, I think that indigent defense and even maybe criminal defense has been viewed at best with, you know, benign neglect, and at worst with deliberate indifference, that there are people in the system of government and in the system that view what defense attorneys do as a gimmick, as a roadblock, as a impediment to, we all know people are guilty. And that the people that need our services, unfortunately, like many of the populations that need to take advantage of our safety nets, are others. And that is a problem broader than the criminal system, the otherness of our fellow citizens, of our fellow humans. And when it's easy to think of those are others, those aren't people like us, those are people, I'll never be in that situation, my family won't be in that situation, that I think it explains the context of how we had a system where a constitutional right, you know, from 1790, whatever, was, yeah, come on down and get on the list. Because they became judges and went to law school in that environment. So it's just that culture makes it difficult for the commission to get traction they had direct contact with the Judiciary Committee, but there was some inertia there to overcome. But then with the committees in the governor's office where they don't have regular interactions with, just falling on deaf ears and appropriations and in other decision makers. So I think it's important to that sort of headwind is still exists and is sort of influenced all the different factors that people have discussed so far.
So I just wanted to add to something that Rob said, and Josh, you led with some horrifying numbers about the number of people who are not represented currently. A number that keeps coming up for me is that the system, the judicial system, is holding on in the criminal side to more than 5,000 additional cases than we had in December 2019. More than 5,000 cases. A significant part of that, I think maybe 3,000 are felonies. Okay, so let's just assume most, if not all of those, require counsel. Somehow, I don't know how we've done it, the defense bar, such as it exists now, has been able to represent, I guess, 4,000 of those cases, take on still those 4,000 extra cases. The system just keeps expanding and we keep increasing capacity. And unfortunately, there is a limit. And I think that's where this number has been increasing exponentially over the past year. We should not have a backlog in almost 2025. It's horrifying that we do. Having more counsel is not the solution. And I'm sure other people will speak on that. Solution is getting rid of horrible old cases.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's something I wanted to ask you all about is, you know, there essentially is a supply and demand problem here, right? There's a demand created by criminal cases and there's a supply of defense attorneys. Or feel free to disagree. But what I was going to say is, I think a lot of the dialogue is about increasing the supply of defense attorneys and not so much about changing the number of cases. And what I guess I wanted to hear from all of you about, are there ways in which we can reduce the number of cases, you know, without, I think some members of the public would say, well, you're just not, you know, people are going to commit crimes and get away with it. And I wanted to hear.
Yes, because that's the biggest injustice. Somebody might get away with a theft, a shoplifting case. Right. That is the injustice of the century.
So I'll throw something out. Maybe go back to DACA call day and get rid of the dispositional conference. Mm-hmm. But they won't do it. But back when I was a boy, right?
It's not the process broken, Ron. It's not the process.
Used to force the decision makers to make a decision, because on Thursday they'd have to decide what they were going to try on Monday or Tuesday, and they would force them to make a decision. Before we had the unified docket, and you'd go to district court. Mm-hmm. And you'd file your motion to discuss if you were in Southern Maine. In Northern Maine, they didn't. It was Rule 22, was it?
Why are you asking me? I'm not that old.
Okay.
Don't ask me. I'm
just. But you'd file a motion. You'd file a motion to suppress. They were called motions to discuss. You'd go to district court. And you'd also file your jury trial request. So you'd file JTR and you'd withdraw your motion if you didn't get what you wanted in district court and go up to Superior Court where you'd be able to put more pressure on the system. It would force decisions by prosecutors.
Here's the problem. A significant majority of prosecutors in the state have never tried a real case. And I'll tell you what, a significant majority of younger defense attorneys or newer defense attorneys also haven't tried a real case. They don't know what a case is worth. They don't know issues. They don't know how to litigate the dispositive stuff. It's a huge problem. That being said, I'm not letting judges off the hook. And I'm not letting legislators off the hook. Speedy trial, joke. The bill that was discussed was gutted. There's no speedy trial right in Maine. Let's be for real. And judges have 48B, Rule 48B. I do know that one. And they could dismiss things for delays, unreasonable delays. And ain't 4 years an unreasonable delay. Ain't a year an unreasonable delay on a misdemeanor. So these are the decision makers. They're not making any decisions except to do nothing.
You can't.
Just one thing.
No.
Okay.
Only I get to talk over.
One thing is, part of the problem also, remember, is that a unified spokesperson for the bar, the defense bar, I mean, is missing. What I mean by that is, when the prosecutors meet with the judges, there's not necessarily a chief public defender in the room discussing something as part of that three-legged stool. And that, I think, is a significant problem as well. Mm-hmm. It's too dispersed. There's no concerted effort to file. Everybody files the same motion for speedy trial, right? It's just, there's just not that. That's the advantage, I think. Go ahead.
I think that we're the problem.
We're the problem?
We're the problem.
Who's we? Define your term.
That it's that you have three lawyers sitting here. The question you asked about, you know, what can we do about the inputs to the system, the number of cases in the system that doesn't cause non-lawyers, great, you know, the rest of society, including lawyers, to be freaked out and worried about the consequences of it. We need to have a discussion. And I think a chief public defender is a key part of that in terms of not just lawyering, but having a discussion in our society that is broader about what are the problems and causes of cases ending up in the criminal system? And as a society, what resources do we want to bring to bear to solve them, and in what arenas? A homeless alcoholic individual with mental health issues, I can't imagine that a cross-section of our society that sat down and had a series of discussion and got information from experts and other stakeholders would decide, no, we're just going to arrest them, throw them in jail, and then charge them for drinking in public or whatever, and then give them a little bit of jail sentence and send them on their way. Like, no, that as a way to address an issue, and that's just one tiny little one. I can't imagine our society would decide that's what we're going to do. That makes sense. And the issue is we don't have an ability yet, or in a form in a to have that conversation, so that as a society we can make the decisions of, you know, somebody, you know, kidnapping people and burning down buildings, that's cases we want addressed in the criminal system. And someone who's suffering from a disease, we want to give them the counseling and the medicine and the treatment that they need, or the services that we believe as a society are in place in this safety net to address the issues, not just charge them and dump them into a criminal system that doesn't have the resources or the ability or the knowledge and expertise to address the issue. So I think that's what I mean by where the problem is, that we aren't a bigger cross-section of society talking about how we want to do this. Because I think that there are so many cases that don't need to be in our system and could safely not be in our system. Yeah. And if we took those resources and address the issues that led to the conduct that people are worried about, we would achieve more improvement for the clients and for society. So.
You're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. This month, we're bringing you a panel of experts on the state's indigent defense crisis.
In that same vein, I'm wondering, you know, not having a lawyer obviously hurts your sort of case in all these different ways. But I guess I'm sort of wondering, I don't know, what you would say to someone who said, well, they didn't have a lawyer for a month, but they got a lawyer, so in the end, it was fine, you know? And I guess I'm just sort of wondering what, along that way you're talking about, like the sort of non-legal sort of wraparound way in which defense is practiced, that it matters that you get a lawyer right away.
I'll just pick that up very quickly.
Yeah.
Just because I represented, I did criminal work in a private law firm. Right. So I did work for people often with means who had never encountered the justice system. And that's the way you talk to people, because all of those people wanted a lawyer immediately, wanted to get out of jail immediately. And when sitting in court, thought, what the hell is this? What's this system? This is weird. Why do I have to sit here for 4 hours or 5 hours or 6 hours or all day, right? Waiting for my case to be handled. That's the way I think you talk to people is, do you want your son or daughter to be mistakenly accused? Let's just use that
hypothetical and have them sit. What would you think about that? Would you go walk into court? And when everybody's being sworn in, all the new attorneys are being sworn in and say, hey, one of you who's really passionate about criminal defense, would you represent my son who's been charged with domestic violence by his girlfriend that I think she's lying? They'd all say no. I mean, I think that's the way. I mean, I know Rob wants to fix society, but I think you just, within this system, you have to really fight the government and put them to the test, because I don't know that we're going to solve human nature's desire to separate themselves from others unless you try to make them somehow relate in their own world to that situation.
If we just magically upped pay for lawyers, for indigent defense lawyers, to say 300 an hour tomorrow or 400 an hour, does that solve anything? Do we bring people into
we have a bigger bathtub. What I mean by that is this: imagine that the criminal system is a bathtub,
yeah,
and water is pouring into it,
right?
And there's only so much draining it at a certain size, and water is pouring into it, pouring into it, pouring into it. And different players may be a pencil, a spoiled child splashing the water and getting it to, you know, splash out when it's not at capacity, maybe not. But the water is just pouring in, and is overflowing. And adding more lawyers just says, if you look at that problem, not pull the drain so we can get cases out of here, not turn the faucet down so that it's not filling up faster. It's, oh, we need more bathtub. No one looks at that problem and their first reaction is, oh, we just need a bigger bathtub. But that essentially is what, when people keep talking about the number of attorneys, that's what we're talking about, is not looking at the inputs, not looking at how the system flows in terms of cases being resolved justly and quickly, but rather we just need a bigger holding tank. And so upping the pay, if it were to, you know, get more attorneys in doing a good job and being involved, really is just putting some sandbags on the side of the tub until it overflows again.
Right.
And is that how it is, that the best use of our money, if there's a better way to reduce the amount of water coming into that tub?
So my mother did not raise a fool. I am not going to argue against an increase in pay. $300, sure. I think my private rate right now is $350 or $400. If they want to pay me more money, who am I to say no? Okay. Here's the thing. We went up to $150, and I think March of 2023, and I see Jim back there. You can correct me for all the things I'm saying wrong, but you know, I think there was a misapprehension in the legislature and in the public. Oh, they got more money. Why isn't the problem fixed? Because there were so many other issues for why people are either not doing the work or whatever. But I also think a metric that's never been studied is, what did that increase in pay do for the people who were on the cusp of leaving, like done, versus staying on? It kept more of us in the system. Okay. Is it the cure-all, an increase in pay? No. Is just adding more attorneys the solution to all problems? Absolutely not. If anyone wants to give me more money, they're welcome to it. You know, I think especially for the higher level cases, that would make a lot of sense. But no, money doesn't fix all the problems in the commission, but it doesn't hurt either.
And I think that there's the opportunities to examine how can more resources be brought to bear, even within our system, not just more attorneys. For example, starting this summer, we're going to be the recipients of a grant where we're going to have a client advocate in our office, one of the first in the state. And that will, not an attorney, but that will allow our attorneys to do better work and, all else being equal, to take slightly more cases, because some of the work in terms of prepping some mitigation or negotiating information that isn't, you need to be a lawyer to get this document or to get these records, or to get this information from the client is being done by someone who's better trained to do it, freeing up the attorneys to do work that it supposedly you need to be an attorney to do. And I say supposedly because since our system only pays for the attorney and no and nothing else, we do everything in the office. But there, that's just one example of there may be more resources that can be brought into the system that can help assign counsel do better jobs and to be able to do maybe take slightly more cases. And really, you know, another voice that we don't have here, and it's a frequent, not frequently missing, it's almost entirely missing, is the clients. What's it like to be a recipient of legal services in Maine? And I know it varies, good experiences, bad experiences, and perceived bad experiences from excellent work, et cetera, but I have found that even after all these years, I still am learning things I had no idea of how it impacts clients. And you mentioned, what's the big deal with getting an attorney? They got one after a month or 2 months or whatever. Well, let's put you up at a hotel where you can't leave it and you can't make any calls or access the internet, and tell me what falls apart in your life after 3 weeks.
How are people not burning down?
And you've got a job and savings and everything. If you've got, if you're already at the edge and suddenly disruption like that happens, the impact on individuals in terms of losing those safety nets that leads to, statistically speaking, more involvement in the system is profound. And so that's some of the impact, but just it, some of these, many of these cases have implications, even if they're not in jail, that are ripping their lives apart in terms of bail restrictions, or just the stress of what's going to happen to me, or even losing their driver's license when it, maybe that could be avoided. The, you know, I went up to Aroostook County for the second time in my life in September and went all the way up to Fort Kent and was able to appreciate the fact that it is the geographic size of Rhode Island and Connecticut combined. And we have laws in our books that take away people's licenses for all sorts of things that don't involve dangerousness in driving. The impact that that has on individuals and then them just never getting off the conveyor belt of being in the system is tremendous. And so I think we really, it is a huge impact on people's lives, even if they're not in custody, without a lawyer to guide them. And also without a lawyer that is doing the absolute best for that client and meeting with them ahead of time, investigating, working up the mitigation to, I know they were suspended, but here's the thing. They've got three kids, two of which are special needs, and they've got to get into disappointments, and this is what's going to happen to their license. Can't we do a filing or something that doesn't result in breaking that chain? Not everybody gets that, and they should.
Can I just ask, which, from these two, is there a problem, you think, in the way that prosecutors are being trained? What, or is it just an attitude?
There are people who lead prosecutors' offices in the state who I don't think know the law, rules of ethics, nothing. And they're the ones responsible for supervising line prosecutors who have people's lives in their hands. So yeah, it's an absence of training, absence of experience, lack of accountability. It's all three.
So it goes to the issue of power. Mel Zar, professor at the UMaine Law School, he's going to talk criminal law. One of the, his things, he was always talking to the people, the future prosecutors, because of the power they had and how they used it, shouldn't use it responsibly. And in my experience, I had prosecutors use it responsibly. I don't know.
What's one of the things that's interesting, if you look, talk about power, you've got the state of Maine, which is responsible for providing counsel to these individuals. And that's who the prosecutors represent. And the prosecutors, though, face no limits on their ability to bring cases. They bring cases without any regard to the ability of their client to staff them. And it's just... It's interesting that the powers that be put no check on them and say, you know, listen, you can bring as many cases of whatever type you want. that you can staff, for example. That concept is viewed as ridiculous and absurd, but their client controls and is responsible, controls how much resources are put in and in what method, and controls what discretion is authorized. This crisis is going on, and yet they are still charging shopliftings as felonies from big box stores. How do you, as a prosecutor, square this shoplifting from Walmart is so important, I'm going to charge it as a felony, implicating the right to counsel, despite the fact that there are no attorneys to staff domestic violence cases and child sex cases? What goes into that couch other than I have nothing to do with it and it got nothing to do with my decision-making? No one is holding them accountable. And I think that isn't just the prosecutors, because nobody's holding them accountable. Like, we file motions, we make arguments about the Sixth Amendment. There is nothing that is happening from any other decision makers that causes them to change their behavior and exercising their discretion. Additionally, data, the information that's out there. How many people have pled guilty after they have been found indigent and having a right to counsel, but yet before counsel was eventually assigned? I don't know. Nobody knows. The judicial branch doesn't track that data. Their current database and probably their future one doesn't have fields that would allow for that data to be tracked. Why? Why would they design a database that where you wouldn't be able to check, you know, run a search for, you know, right to counsel found, and then be able to search for null or whatever the database equivalent is for attorney assigned, and that the case is resolved by a guilty plea? It should be an easy thing to track. And remember, when I talked about benign neglect at best, what caused me to either snap or go on this crusade was when back in 2000, end of 2006, beginning of 2007, the judicial branch was facing that budgetary crisis. You know, there's a balanced budget requirement. So they had to come up with a plan to balance their budget, holding judge positions open and clerk's positions open. You know, they had to have a plan. And part of their plan was for 6 months, the last 6 months of the fiscal year, if you were an adult and were going into court but weren't in custody, they did away with the Lawyer of the Day program for 6 months. You would go into court, there'd be no defense attorney there. And I bet if you look back at that 6 months and got the data as to how many cases pled guilty and then looked at those cases and figured out how many of those were at first appearance, you would see hundreds and hundreds of cases that the judicial branch had no problem taking guilty pleas at initial appearance, even though there were no lawyers of the day. And these aren't evil people. This is just the way it had been. Yeah. There was nobody out there pointing out the problems with the cases. And previously, there was no one for them to consult in that decision. When I talk about, and Ron talks about, the chief public defender, if we had had a chief public defender, when that plan was announced, I'm pretty sure she would have had something to say about it in terms of what the implication of that would be. But it was a vacuum when it happened. So that's a lot of the issue, is that there's a lot that's out there that we don't know about, that we can't access it. And it's not, I'm told, easily accessible in terms of the data. But it seemed, if we were that concerned as a society as to the issues that were being caused, then I can't imagine that there wouldn't be a way where this sort of information was being tracked and accessible so that we could quantify the issue. And we, as a society, would be holding the decision makers of the gatekeepers of cases coming into the system accountable to, you got to match the ability of your client, the state of Maine, to staff it. We're not telling you which cases. We want you to make good, sound prosecutorial discretion as to priority and safety of the community and the individuals. But yet, shoplifting from Walmart, it's a felony because they've had two, in the last 10 years, they had two other thefts. So we're just charging it as a felon. How? What's the calculus that led to that?
What responsibility do judges have then to be like
a lot?
Yeah.
You know, why are you bringing this?
But
you have to match it.
And part of it, this is a resource issue too. Anybody who goes into federal court, right, knows that the process is so much different than in state court. And you can have to appear in front of a judge in federal court in chambers conference and explain and have the prosecutor explain just how he's going to meet the elements of the crime. The judge will actually, you know, might actually take a that serious a look at it. Is this really the right charge? That doesn't happen in state court. You can stand in state court, and this is a real example, is see someone plead guilty at initial appearance to shoplifting a bottle of Advil, 70-year-old man, and the fine is $250, that he's going to pay $10 a month. And the judge doesn't say, I'm sorry, this is ridiculous. You're not doing that. With $250, $10 a month for 20, you know, no. Or I've witnessed a defendant argue bail better than his lawyer. Lawyer standing next to him, doesn't say anything. The defendant starts arguing bail. Judge doesn't take that lawyer back in the chambers and to the woodshed. In federal court,
you get pulled off the panel.
But you get reamed publicly.
Yeah, that too. But
I sat there watching someone get reamed out as I played with my pen. I mean, you know, and tried to, you know, not pay attention. But so it's a sort of a resource and pay attention and how serious is this kind of thing. So I have a lot of respect for our judges. I do, but I did. Go ahead.
No, I think the problem that I was stating with the newer attorneys, prosecutors, even some with significant experience, and honestly, I know some defense attorneys who have been doing this almost 10 years, never had a trial. It flows up to the judges we have in Maine, the state court judges, so many of them have not presided over many trials. They didn't do many trials as long. They don't know what a case is worth. They don't think it's their place to push the prosecutors on what a case is worth and why the hell are we here. They don't see it as their role. When we have a few judges who do see that as their role, we get things resolved.
You've been listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a collaboration between WERU-FM and the nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. To listen to the rest of this panel, along with conversations about neighboring states' models and the rollout of Maine's new public defender system, and to learn more about our reporting on the issue, visit themainemonitor.org. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. The Maine Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can also listen on the WERU app, subscribe to the show as a podcast, or download archived shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Stephanie McFeeters, and this is Community Radio WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill. Thanks for listening, and Happy New Year.